Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What started as a run-of-the-mill corporate buyout offer has turned into what you might fairly call a soap opera with a cast of characters to make your head spin. First, it was just Microsoft and Yahoo in the starring roles. But now, the bid players have started edging into the spotlight. We'll unravel Micro AOL Yah News Corp on the program today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this 10th of April. It is a Thursday today. It is getting so you can't tell the players without a program, so here you go. Just to recap, Microsoft wants to buy Yahoo for something north of $42 billion. Yahoo's not all that interested. Yesterday, it made a short-term ad deal with Google, you know, just to test the waters. Cut now to Microsoft. There are reports today Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is helping the software giant with its bid. Murdoch owns MySpace, remember? And there is a subplot that has Time Warner selling its struggling America Online to Yahoo to help Yahoo stave off Microsoft. If you happen to have been able to keep all that straight, then Marketplace's Lisa Napoli says there is one more thing you need to remember.
All this whispering and backdoor dealing comes down to this.
It is all driven by fear of Google.
That's media analyst Rafat Ali of PaidContent.org. He says even if Microsoft, News Corp, and Yahoo get together, and that's a big if, they still won't out-Google Google.
Even all of these three combined will have a tough time catching up to Google in terms of revenue.
In terms of audience, the still theoretical triumvirate would be massive. And that's part of the allure for News Corp, which has been looking for ways to make more cash from its social networking site, MySpace. Longtime net watcher and Vanity Fair media critic Michael Wolff is writing a book about News Corp.
The News Corp people are not stupid, and they're looking at MySpace in this direct face-to-face competition with Facebook.
Of course, social networking could just be the flavor of the month on the internet, just like Yahoo and its new would-be ally America Online once were golden. Media analysts don't seem to think a Yahoo-AOL alliance will work. Jeff Chester of the Center for Democratic Media says all these deals may be good for business, but they're lousy for those of us who use the net.
For consumers, what it means is fewer choices in terms of search engines, their data being harvested by fewer but more powerful companies. And it's not good when the bigger companies get bigger and the competitors are reduced.
Even though regulators have allowed other cross-internet marriages of late. For now, figuring out how to grab the biggest slice of the advertising pie is what's keeping media and technology moguls scrambling for deals. Most everyone seems to think that in the end, Microsoft's going to get what it's been after all along, Yahoo. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Today is day three of delays for passengers on American Airlines. The country's biggest carrier has canceled 2,500 flights over the past 72 hours. It's trying to get right with a Federal Aviation Administration maintenance and inspection audit. CEO Gerald Arpey got on the phone with reporters today to say, in essence, that he was sorry. He also said the whole debacle is going to cost the company in the tens of millions of dollars. On Capitol Hill, Senator Jay Rockefeller was chairing a committee hearing on the cancellations and aviation safety. He put the blame squarely on the FAA.
The FAA is an agency spiraling downward and I think approaching the losing of the confidence of the American people and of the Congress.
We got the February trade numbers this morning. The deficit rose nearly 6%, kind of surprising when everybody had thought there would be a decline. A good part of the rising trade gap has been our imbalance with China, a condition not helped in our favor by the strength of the Chinese currency. It was pegged at just over 8 yuan to the dollar for many years. Beijing started to let it trade somewhat freely in 2006. Washington's been vocal about its desire for more ever since. And today, the yuan fell below 7 to the dollar for the first time. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports this is a classic case of being careful what you ask for.
China's been keeping its currency artificially cheap. Most people say if the UN could float freely, it would actually be worth a lot more than it is. That would make American goods exported to China cheaper, so China would import more goods from the U.S., and the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China would be, if not balanced, at least a little more even. David Solon is a currency consultant. He says it's starting to happen, sort of.
Any kind of strengthening of their currency will have the net effect of making price of U.S. goods there cheaper.
Here's where the sort of part comes in.
There's no magic price per se where suddenly, you know, Chinese consumers will say, okay, we want all of these U.S. goods.
Part of the problem, Solon says, is that it's not just exchange rates that determine how much an American product costs in China or that make Chinese consumers want to or be able to buy them. Among other things, inflation is very high in China right now, so everything costs more. That's partly because the yuan has been falling against other currencies, just not against the dollar. Ronald McKinnon is a professor of international economics at Stanford. He says the U.S. might not really want that trade imbalance to correct itself.
If China were to suddenly correct its trade surplus, that would mean so much less Chinese capital coming into the saving deficient American economy.
And that, he says, would cause a major credit crisis, much worse even than the one we're already in. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Retail sales drove investors today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Washington's the place to be for international finance groupies this week. The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the Group of Seven countries are getting together for their annual spring meetings. Throw a couple of the big central banks into the mix, and it's shaping up to be quite a party. Unfortunately, the topic at hand is one we're all far too familiar with. We've got Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the line to hash it over. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So they are gathering these various international financial and economic bodies. I imagine topic A on the table has to be the credit crunch, right?
Very much so. And they're going to be talking essentially about two kinds of plan. First of all, how do we get out of the mess we're in at the moment? And secondly, how do we avoid getting into this kind of mess in the future?
What exactly can they hope to do about it? I mean, Washington's been having the devil's own time trying to figure it out.
Well, they're going to talk about what Washington has been up to, and they're going to be looking at the whole tactic and the tools that have been deployed, like central banks, the Fed cutting interest rates quite savagely, lending a lot more money to the commercial banks, and accepting a wider range of securities as collateral and so on. Interestingly, the IMF earlier this week has floated a very radical proposal, which is certainly not going to be very popular with taxpayers.
Well, spill it, Stephen. What is it?
It's something actually rather along the lines of the Resolution Trust Corporation.
Oh, yeah. From savings and loan days, right?
The savings and loan disaster in the late 80s and early 90s. What the IMF appears to be proposing is taxpayer-funded bodies like that, which would buy up the commercial banks' bad debts, leaving the banks with the good debts so that they would then be free to borrow and lend again. Now, clearly, this is not going to be popular with taxpayers, with individual taxpayers, or, I imagine, with non-financial businesses, many of whom, it seems, feel pretty bitter about the way the banks have created this mess through, you know, a mixture of greed and, not to put too fine a point on it, stupidity.
Yeah, now this is what's called a ministerial level meeting. That is to say, not the heads of state and the chiefs of government. They meet in May. So it still has to be voted on, in effect, by presidents and prime ministers. What do you think the actual G7 leaders are going to say?
The prevailing mood seems to be that we are past the worst in this crisis. I mean, stock markets are certainly here in Europe and in the US seem to think so. The US market is about 8 or 9% above its low point in March. So politicians who might be seeking re-election are not going to want to frighten the voters by adopting a radical plan like this, which might not be needed anyway. But one interesting theory I've heard from a think tank here in London called the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation is that actually the G7 finance chiefs put the IMF up to floating this plan. They'd like to have this plan out there in the open without their fingerprints on it, so that if the credit crunch does turn really nasty, then this could be wheeled out of the wings without causing too much shock and implemented.
All economics and politics really is local. Stephen Beard at the European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
Here's today's Man Bites Dog story from the Mergers and Acquisitions file. Canada's had a law in the books for about 20 years now that lets the government block some foreign takeovers of domestic businesses, specifically takeovers of firms that are worth more than $270 million Canadian, about $265 U.S. Anyway, the law has never been used until today. And here's the kicker. The foreign company being blocked is American. Yes, the other half of the world's biggest bilateral trade relationship. It seems a U.S. company called Alliant Tech Systems wanted to buy a Canadian enterprise with some very attractive satellite technology. But Jeremy Hobson reports the $1.3 billion offer wasn't enough to overcome Ottawa's worries about national security.
Alliant reached a deal back in January to buy the Canadian company McDonald Detweiler and Associates. Now, you may not have heard of MDA, but those in the space community know all about it. It invented a highly sophisticated satellite system called RADARSAT-2 that can see through clouds. Teresa Hitchens with the Center for Defense Information says it's the crown jewel of the Canadian space industry.
Without MDA, Canada essentially doesn't have a space industry.
And without MDA satellite technology, Canada would lose a major advantage in the battle for the emerging Arctic Passage, said to hold a quarter of the world's untapped oil and gas reserves.
And RADARSAT is the only Canadian asset that could actually see, for example, U.S. submarines under the Arctic.
That national security concern and significant taxpayer investment in RADARSAT makes the issue a hot potato in Ottawa. Here's the industry minister Jim Prentice on the floor of the House of Commons today.
This government, as the Prime Minister has noted, is committed to our sovereignty, committed to a radar program, committed to what we have been able to achieve in this country in space, Mr. Speaker.
But still, should the U.S. take this as an insult? Absolutely not, says Michael Hart, a trade expert at Carleton University in Ottawa.
Just think about it the other way around, that a private company sells part of its assets to a Canadian company, and it includes control over Cape Canaveral. How would the American people think about that?
The American company, Alliant, wouldn't comment except to say conversations with Canada are ongoing, as is a 30-day appeal period. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. The nation's retailers reported their weakest March sales in 13 years today, but that didn't keep the stock market down. The Dow Industrials climbed 54 points, 0.4%, finished at 12,581. A buying spree in the tech sector boosted the NASDAQ 29 points, more than 1.25%, ended the day at 2351. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 0.4%, wrapped up at 1360. Retail results out today suggest consumers are confining their buying to food and other necessities. That wasn't such a bad thing for sales at Walmart stores, though, and stock in the bargain retailer gained around 1%. Buying was also up at Costco, the big warehouse chain. Its shares rose 0.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford, on DVD today. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Council of Institutional Investors wraps up its spring meeting. Agenda items address thinking globally. The museum holds its grand opening ceremonies in Washington. The Museum of News is free on opening day. And a trivia marathon kicks off in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Billed as the world's largest trivia contest, contestants answer questions for 3 days if they can think that long. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Senate passed its version of the mortgage rescue bill today. It's not at all certain the thing will make it through the House as it's written now, and President Bush has said he's not wild about it. But in the meanwhile, there is a little something for everyone to be had. People who buy up foreclosed properties will get a tax credit. Homeowners facing foreclosure will get credit counseling if they want it. Local governments are eligible for a couple of $1 billion to buy and repair foreclosed homes. And commentator Jeff Birnbaum points out there is another winner, too.
The Senate has now passed legislation that addresses the recent meltdown in housing. The bipartisan plan has several components, but one of its largest is a surprise $6 billion in tax credits to help not homeowners, but home builders. Under the proposal, home construction firms could use their losses suffered last year and this year to claim rebates against the big profits they posted in years past. No other industry stands to get more out of the bill. Why so much largesse? Proponents say a healthy home building sector is key to a growing economy, and that may well be so. But the tax breaks are also the result of a very public and apparently successful extortion attempt of sorts by the home builders' lobby. So how do they pull it off? A couple months ago, the National Association of Home Builders took an unusual step. They announced they would stop giving millions of dollars in campaign donations until further notice. They didn't say exactly why, but at the time, builders were angry the Senate had not approved those very same tax credits, among other expensive benefits the industry had sought. In the weeks since then, the home builders have lobbied hard for help from Congress. They've sent letters to lawmakers and made personal visits to Capitol Hill. Those efforts surely had an impact, but I think it's fair to say that the money mattered more. The home builders have one of the biggest political action committees in corporate America, and lawmakers didn't want to give up all those donations. After all, money is the mother's milk of politics, and the Senate clearly isn't the kind of place that likes to go thirsty. No word yet on whether the home builders will open their money spigot and begin to give out contributions again, but it would be a good guess that they will, if those tax breaks become law.
Jeff Birnbaum is a columnist at the Washington Post. Some of the big home builders did well today on the markets. Pulte, for one, rose nearly 3%. KB Home was up a bit less than 1% on the New York Stock Exchange. Overall this year, the home builders index has spiked almost 30%. Send us your comments on what Mr. Birnbaum said or the folks he was talking about. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. Most of the time, when you hear about problems in healthcare, it's a question of not enough money or not enough doctors. That's usually the case in cities. They're often short on both. And as a result, many urban hospitals are struggling to care for low-income patients. One medical center in Boston has led the search for a solution in a completely different direction, though. It's hired attorneys to help fight illness and disease among the poor. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
My name's Dr. The ER.
Poor families with no alternative bring their sick children to the emergency room. Not only is this about the most expensive way to get health care, the conditions that bring impoverished kids back to the ER again and again are often preventable. Ellen Lawton is executive director of the Medical Legal Partnership for Children at Boston Medical Center.
We have families that we see, for example, who are diabetic. And when their utilities are shut off, they're not able to keep their medicines refrigerated the way they're supposed to. And as a result, they end up in the emergency room instead of being able to administer some of these treatments at home.
Chairman of Pediatrics Barry Zuckerman treated children with malnutrition who had been denied food stamps and kids with ear infections who lived in homes with no heat. Treating the ear infection was easy, but there was little Zuckerman could do about the utility problem. Then he hired a lawyer.
And that maybe these problems of poor people that are causing illness actually has legal remedies.
Say a disadvantaged child lives in an apartment with a leaky pipe. The landlord refuses to fix it, even though the leak is causing mold, and mold can trigger respiratory problems. That's where the medical center's staff attorney, Johanna Flax, comes in.
There are landlords who will not respond until the matter is ratcheted up to one that is officially legal in nature.
Or economic. Dr. Zuckerman says slumlords will only make improvements if it's more expensive not to.
They have a choice to make. They can either spend the $50 and fix the leaky pipe and clean it up, or they can go to court with a lawyer. And they certainly don't want to do the latter. It's too expensive.
¿Quieres comer?
In her small apartment in Northern California, Angelica, a Mexican immigrant, cooks for her three children. The three-year-old twins have Cabbage Patch dolls and plastic horses to play with. Until recently, the floor where the kids play threatened the health of her seven-year-old son. He has asthma and suffered allergies and headaches. Angelica took him to a doctor who told her to tear out the old carpet.
I asked the manager to remove the old carpet from the apartment, but the manager wouldn't do it.
That's when her doctor put Angelica in touch with a lawyer through Peninsula Family Advocacy Program. The lawyer contacted the apartment manager. Next thing you know, the old carpet is gone. And her son?
Much better. My son no longer suffers from headaches and allergies. With the help of the lawyer, everything is good.
The concept is catching on. Across the country, there are more than 80 medical legal partnerships. In addition to helping the poor, they can help hospitals recoup insurance dollars. Again, Dr. Zuckerman at Boston Medical Center.
So our lawyers, by helping out the patients, actually also accrues value in dollars to the hospital because in many cases they can find that such and such condition was covered and the hospital should be paid for the services that was provided to the patient.
The partnerships can also boost a medical facility's reputation, says staff attorney Johanna Flax.
They're investing in being able to say, we perhaps have fewer emergency room admissions for our pediatric primary care patients.
Cutting back on ER visits isn't just for kids. Medical legal partnerships are being expanded to help cancer victims, geriatric patients, and other vulnerable groups, all confronting health care problems with a doctor-lawyer 1-2 punch. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Somewhere right near the top of your list of things to do this weekend ought to be three little letters, I, R, and S. Not only are taxes due soon, but if you don't get them done, you might miss out on some free cash because Uncle Sam's going to be giving away money this year. The rebate checks most of us are going to get came with the stimulus package Congress and the White House agreed to a couple of months ago. But as with so many things having to do with your taxes, there is a catch, or 10. Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program, Marketplace Money, which means we go to her when we've got tax questions. Hiya, Tess.
Hello, Kai.
Explain to me, would you, why we still have to talk about this?
Well, because there is still a raft of confusion about the stimulus check. People are very excited to get it, of course.
Yeah, right.
But there are some misconceptions about what that check is going to mean in the overall tax picture, specifically for 2008. Why talk about it right now? Because, it's less than a week until tax day. And you cannot get one of these checks unless you file tax forms for 2007. No exceptions. You do not file, you do not get a check.
Say that again.
You do not file, you do not get
there
a check.
All right. So let's unearth some of these misconceptions and then knock them down. One of the big questions we've been getting in our inbox is this stimulus check going to be taxed next year?
And the answer, Kai, is an unequivocal no.
All right.
You will not pay taxes on the stimulus check. The IRS says next year there may be a line on your tax forms asking you to say how much you received.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that is that you may have actually been underpaid this year in terms of your stimulus if your situation changed. So they want you to go ahead and put that on your form next year, and you may actually get more money. They will not take away from you if your situation changed for the negative. You will still get to keep all that money. But that's really the only thing that's going to happen on your 2008 taxes. This money will not be taxed.
Is it going to affect next year's refund, though?
That's a really big one that seems to be out there a lot. In fact, we actually have someone here at Marketplace whose accountant told her that this check was an advance on next year's refund and that she should plan for her 2008 taxes accordingly. It's simply not true. This check will not affect next year's taxes really at all. And, you know, Kai, we've been trying to figure out where all this information has come from,
right.
Specifically this notion that this is an advance on next year. Well, I called the very kind people at the IRS. And
probably ought to say that again, too.
Yeah, very kind. And they reminded me that actually the last time the federal government issued checks back in 2001, that stimulus was indeed an advance of sorts on the Bush administration's tax cuts, where the bottom line went from 15 to 10%. So maybe folks are assuming that it is the same this time. It is not. This is not an advance on next year's refund.
All right. One last thing before we go. You have to file this year if you want to get your check. That is, even if you usually wouldn't because you don't make enough money.
That's right. You know, here we're talking about people who are on, say, Social Security, or they're living on veterans benefits, certain railroad retirees, and, of course, folks who don't make enough usually to have to file taxes. Most of those will be eligible for a $300 to $600 check. But they need to file even if they wouldn't usually. And there's a special form called the 1040A. It's very simple. And the IRS will send you a stimulus check as long as you have filed for your taxes for 2007. But if you don't, you will not get a check.
Marketplace's Tess Vigeland. She hosts our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. Thank you, Tess.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, those glued to the tube on Monday night for the NCAA championship game saw the Kansas Jayhawks beat Memphis in a real nail-biter. Maybe you got so excited your throat went dry and you just had to get up and grab a beer. That might have been the game. But maybe it was the 270 seconds of beer advertising you saw that night on the CBS telecast. The Center for Public Interest went and counted up all of the ad time dedicated to drinking during the semifinal games this past weekend. 200 to 240 seconds, well past the NCAA's limit of no more than 2 minutes, which is, of course, 120 seconds. The stats have prompted more than 100 college presidents, coaches, and athletic directors to send a formal complaint to the NCAA. They say that much beer and college basketball just don't mix. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow added 54 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq packed on 29 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 rose 6 points. That's 0.4% there as well. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, political activists turn up the volume in Washington.
Candidates don't like people coming in from the outside saying anything about their election race, but we think that's what the First Amendment's all about.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.